And we are live. This is Dark Journalist. What a fantastic crowd we have out there tonight in the ideas room already. And we have something special for you tonight, a special report where we're going to go deep on the mystery school message and some of the things that have been vouchsafed and left behind from this very interesting series of groups that began to become public to us in the late 19th century. It's going to be a very interesting dive, particularly into the character of J.G. Bennett, as he is the last in the link of that particular mystery school chain, stretching us back all the way through Theosophy, Anthroposophy, and the Fourth Way schools. And I think that that period that we're looking at is right there between 1875 and 1975. It's a 100-year arc period, and then that vouchsafe period. Now we come into that 50-year piece where they kind of leaned back and saw what we would do with all the material. And there are these predictions that are laid out there in relation to the mystery schools and what they expect from us and expect us to go through in the 21st century. And that's going to be our major focus tonight. We don't have the lovely Olivia tonight, but she'll be coming back when the X series comes back on July 29th. But we have some very exciting interviews and special reports for you in the meantime. And also we have Groovy Bean out there in the ideas room and also Gigi Young. It's great to see everyone. Tonight is particularly interesting because we've been, you know, before we get into all the deep material around the mystery schools, I want to say a few things are coming up around the UFO file and a lot of the research that we've done in relation to this. And it's coming in through government sources, which is never a good sign. Actually, it's about the worst that you can get with it. And one of the things that I think is particularly bothersome is that they have this character out there now, Mike Gallagher. And they're using Gallagher instead of Rubio. I think that they started with Rubio, and really Rubio had his hands on that whole, you know, we have a UFO threat and we need to deal with it with a big UAP committee and all this kind of stuff, and always going on the military aside from this and pretending like, oh, we just discovered this thing, we'll have to figure out what it is, when they have 75 years of this material. I think this is a crucial time because what they're doing is they're using this mechanism of the National Defense Authorization Act, which is what they used to get all the emergency powers through the 9/11 emergency powers, which we still are living under, and that's suspension of the Constitution, the introduction of NORTHCOM, which we didn't have before the September 11th attacks. So they accomplished quite a bit with that and the setup after the fact, whether you believe that we were really attacked by terrorists or something else happened. The introduction of NORTHCOM has severely limited privacy rights in this country. And that's something very important for us to watch because it's Homeland Security, you know, DHS with its 250,000 burgeoning bureaucracy or theocracy, as it were, that is coming into your living room now and saying, hey, we're going to handle the UFO thing and we're going to actually cite and punish amateur interest groups. That comes straight out of Congress, if you can believe it. But on the other side of it, they have this Gallagher character, and Gallagher is somebody who's been slated for this, I think, just by his age. They think that they can reach a millennial audience much the same way they were doing that whole thing with Tom DeLonge and all the rest, which we exposed over 4 years, and finally everyone got it. But this is interesting to me because Gallagher went on a radio program and a couple of podcasts right after the congressional hearings back in May, and he starts coming out and saying, oh, maybe, you know, there's time-traveling aliens coming back, you know. So they're, what they're doing is they're mining well-known ideas in the UFO field, and they're adopting them for a narrative purpose. And one of the narrative purposes is a threat. The other one is, oh, hey, these wise elders are going to come back and tell you something. So this is very tricky in government hands because a lot of the stories that have occurred occurred organically, and here they are trying to hype this thing into something else. So that's where we've been doing a lot of the coverage around the emergency powers and the continuity of government program, as many of you know. So I want to go to this article briefly, and we're going to jump in. Like I said, we'll do about 90 minutes tonight, and we'll pick up on questions next time. Although I'll try to sort of get in on the ideas room and throw around a few shout outs and comments. Great to have everyone here with us tonight. All right, House votes to make it easier to report UFOs. Hey, how about that? So suddenly, they want this thing that they've imposed through the CIA, that is the punishment of anybody who talks about it through the X-Protect groups, whose reputations they would destroy, you know, any UFO researcher who came forward and said anything about this on the government side, they just get rid of them. You know, usually in the form of discrediting them, sometimes with very lethal force, going all the way back to the 50s and the Morris K. Jessup stories and so on. But here's the story. House votes to make it easier to report UFOs. This legislation may open the floodgates, said a former Pentagon official. Gee, I can guess who that is. That's Lou Elizondo hanging out back there trying to time the release of his book with this action by Gallagher in Congress. I think that Elizondo is a CIA agent who masqueraded as a whistleblower. And he comes out and, you know, he locked into this whole disclosure realm and tried to pretend that he was disclosing all these things when one after another of the things that he brought forward have either been proven to be outright lies or him, you know, fudging the facts dramatically. And a number of people have exposed it over the course of time. Unfortunately, people who released it in the first place, like the New York Times and all that, got behind it. And so we're stuck with him floating around things like Fox News and CNN, pretending to be an authoritative source. So if you want UFO experts, it's pretty skimpy the way that they handle it on the media side. You're going to wind up with Jeremy Corbell or Luis Elizondo. That's not a very good combination. But anyway, the House on Wednesday voted to create a government system for reporting UFOs to compel current and former officials to reveal what they might know about the mysterious phenomena by promising to protect them from reprisal. Now, here's what's interesting about this. Fundamentally, it would be a good idea to protect whistleblowers. But what they're doing it, this is all a setup now, just like the Navy pilot idea. It's a good thing to take Navy pilots on board. Unfortunately, Navy pilots have been giving us those reports since 1947 and before. So why all of a sudden are they interested? This is the thing. Now they're mimicking a lot of the technology and imitating a threat. So they'll have an honest Navy pilot fly out there, and then they'll throw something like a Tic Tac style technology developed by Lockheed Martin at them and be like, oh, this thing is messing with me. And so they can go back and say, we're under threat, and get funding and a corridor and intelligence oversight and space control, space command, and all the rest of it. And we have to look at that relationship between Space Command, which Luis Elizondo works for, and the CIA, which Elizondo was an agent of the CIA and now works for Space Command. He's not a whistleblower. He's a government employee. And if he was a whistleblower, they'd have thrown him out of government, and that would have been the end of the story, probably in jail, frankly. Instead, you know, he's gallivanting around and putting out these books and pretending to be, you know, oh, a hero for disclosure. But that's all CIA frontman action. We have to be very careful about that. The Gallagher thing is interesting because a lot of these people are getting maneuvered into position. And I think it's important with the two G's, Gallagher and Gallego. We have a third G tonight, which is Gurdjieff, which we're going to get into. But Gallego is another one that we've really pointed out. And I think it's very significant, because Galileo was here at Harvard, and he studied in 2002 and 2004. During that period, he got sent to Iraq and all the rest, and he completely transformed from the person that he was here. But one of the things that he studied at Harvard and in the military was psychological operations. Now, if you're in the military, good. You're going to need people who do psychological operations. There's nothing wrong with that on the face of it. But suddenly, these are the people who are fronting the UFO disclosure piece through government, completely appropriating it from the wishy-washy UFO researchers who were on top of this thing and, you know, getting kind of limper message every year coming out and doing these shows. So they had no support. And so when the CIA version of Disclosure came along, yeah, you know, a lot of them picked up and jumped on it because they were like, hey, you know, my 20 years life work isn't for nothing. And I understand it, but it's not a good reason to work with those people. So this is the mishmash of a situation that we're in. So the UFO field folded and the CIA took it over and then passed the ball to Department of Homeland Security. I kid you not, this is exactly what's happening. And now it's Department of Homeland Security can cite, they're talking about citing and prosecuting people for being amateur interest groups around UFOs. So if you say something, you know, if you take pictures of a UFO and you put it online, they're saying, well, you know, that's a government defense issue and you can't talk about it. This is the kind of illness that they've gone into. And Gallagher, I think, is meant to be like the woo congressman. You know, is he coming out talking about time travel and stuff? And there's no history that Gallejo or Gallagher or any of these people had any public interest in the UFO. Maybe they did privately or whatever, but they're being profiled to be put in these positions. This is a kind of a dangerous game of information control. So that's a lot of the things that we've been pointing out is that this has been coming in combination with the Emergency Powers Acts, with the continuity of government programs. So we need to watch what they're doing with the UFO file in terms of a global threat idea, and then they can have a global emergency, global COG. And what happens in COG when it gets called is that an emergency program kicks in with a totally different order, where you have the NORTHCOM commander, who's General Van Herk, who we've gone into on this program, who also has a couple of different UFO tie-ins, including the fact that he is part of the 509th Bomber Group, which is the same group that discovered Roswell. I find that very unusual. I've run it by a lot of people, like Dr. Farrell, for example, and he thinks that it's a very, very unusual signaling there. So let's go a little bit further on this. The bipartisan amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act passed. The House is set to continue debating amendments on the defense bill. The Senate has also been exerting greater oversight on the UFO issue. The Senate Intelligence Committee's version of the Fiscal 2023 Intelligence Authorization Act calls for enhancing oversight from the Department of Defense collection and reporting on unidentified aerospace and undersea phenomena. The undersea part is crucial to pay attention to because we've been talking so much about land rising, and we're going to get into land rising in this program as well, because it's a key issue and it's something that you never hear about in relation to any of these things, even for people who are trying to uncover these mysteries. And I find that very significant. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. This is a special report on the Mystery School predictions and the things that these very interesting groups trying to move the culture have left vouchsafed for us. And if we can kind of unlock that coded message that they've left, we get a great jump on what's happening here in the 21st century, which they foresaw. I want to remind you to go to darkjournalist.com and sign up for our newsletter. That's how we stay in touch through the massive disinformation and censorship campaigns that are going on. And that's really just a free newsletter that lets you know the incredible interviews and shows that we have coming up for you. And I can tell you that the summer is going to be absolutely riveting with some of our best guests, including Gigi Young, of course, and some real surprises. So make sure you're on that newsletter. We're also going to announce some very interesting documentaries and events for later this summer into fall. So you're not going to want to miss it. And I'll say one other thing about, you know, censorship. But when you know it's on this kind of overdrive, and we've seen it, you know, in relation to the medical stuff, it just went completely off the charts. And yet now so many of the things that they were blocking, we know, are coming out even in mainstream channels, that there was a lot of things that they didn't include as part of the background and all the, you know, hijinks around the COVID op stuff that we've been watching. But as I've repeated on this program before, if you thought the COVID op was something, just wait till the UFO emergency op. That's the one that they've got building up there in the background. Okay, so there's a lot here. And probably at the end of the program, I'll get into some of this UFO news. There's another thing about cosmic landlord cuts otherworldly checks to DeSantis. This is important because it's another one of our friends, Robert Bigelow, Bigelow Aerospace, and he actually donated $10 million to DeSantis. So what is he looking for? What's going on there? And how much are these guys trying to influence the next president to be, you know, disclosure spaceman? Well, in the case of Bigelow, it's a very deep story there. He deserves his own episode for being involved with Skinwalker and all the rest of these UFO things. And of course, the ATIP, and which is a program that didn't exist, and OSAP and all this kind of thing. But Bigelow right in the middle of all this. And basically, this is a guy who develops hotels, lodging, is a millionaire and, you know, a billionaire, somebody really deep in the whole system of finance. And his idea was space tourism, space hotels. So he was going to be well perched for that. But he's somebody who's come off over and over again, very, very deep in his interest. You know, he went on 60 Minutes and said, oh yeah, I think there were aliens. And, you know, I think there was a firefight with aliens in South America and things of this nature. Well, he was close personal friends with Senator Harry Reid, the late Senator Harry Reid. And Harry Reid, of course, being the Senate Majority Leader for Nevada, this is a guy who controlled everything about Area 51, certainly wasn't interested in anything like disclosure. So we have a lot of threads there, but what's interesting about the article is it says the amount exceeds the total combined contributions received this year by both of the Democratic gubernatorial candidates. Las Vegas space entrepreneur who is financing afterlife and UFO research, believes aliens walk among us, has given an astronomical sum to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' political committee, $10 million. Think about that. That's just for openers, folks. Just wait till those black budget floodgates fly wide open. But the question is, what do they expect in return? We know that both sides, whether it's Trump and the Space Force, and I'm sure DeSantis would pick up that mantle, they want to control and contain the UFO file back under presidential control. And right now, it's existing in a really strange corridor of public-private interests, and that's the Intelligent Aerospace Corridor. And with things like the Space Force and with different programs that have been put forward, I mean, Trump's Space Force was really saying, I now control the UFO file because I've defined space as a military objective, so give the UFO threat thing to me. While in the background, the Podesta, Clinton, Elizondo piece was saying, oh, there's a UFO threat, let's go through Congress and give the CIA control over this. So these are the public battles that are going on, but ultimately that executive branch has wanted the control back over the UFO file since it was taken during the Eisenhower administration and then Kennedy's heavy attempt to take it back and then his assassination, direct result of that intense war with the Central Intelligence Agency and this thing that they're connected with on the aerospace side. So, you know, being aware of that battle, moving into some of these headlines with that awareness can help us dramatically when we're looking at this. A lot of the things that we can really say are 21st century issues, like this UFO file piece, the mystery schools and these groups that grew really in the late 19th century as the public mystery schools, like Theosophy, Anthroposophy, Casey's work, the Fourth Way work, and all the things that spun off and around it, we can see them as an acknowledgement by very secretive groups and secret societies over time that things needed to become public because in that public realm, too many truths were being subverted by powerful forces. And so when we go into the mystery schools, when we understand that line, by the time we get to the 21st century, it intersects directly with the UFO file and the manipulation on the UFO file, although it might seem like I'm talking about two completely different tracks, you know, but there's always that crisscross, isn't there? When you get into Crowley, you're talking about a dark aspect of secret societies, but you're also talking about the UFO file if you go into the literature deep enough. So this is how we're going to have to think of these things. It's sort of like we've got this film, this superficial film over everyday reality, but right beneath that, there are these connections that are operating. And at this point, I would say they're operating more and more in the open. So this is the crucial stage for us to see it. And in many cases, they expect us, because of the speed, many of these forces, I've been calling it like the Davos group and these types of things. I mean, it's larger than that, but that's a good, I think a lot of the focus on the alternative side, dealing with the these types of groups is important, actually. So I'm happy to say the Davos group is interwoven because it represents both a corporate and a political piece. So it's not the whole picture by a long shot, but it gives us that really central thing to look at. So what was it that was vouchsafed for us through these mystery schools? And where does that leave us now? What are the threads that we're supposed to pick up? And by the way, how do we, you know, how do we interact or get some deeper information from these mystery schools? Well, these are the great questions, and they've left an awful lot behind for us, I have to say. All right, let's start off with a lot of the pieces that we're looking at in relation to Rudolf Steiner, because I think that Steiner's work in particular comes around on the 21st century peak, very important, not only for his mention of Ahriman and the super technology that was coming as a kind of a, you know, overpowering mankind's will and humanity's soul and things of this nature, but also looking at Steiner, and he's looking out at food. J.G. Bennett from The Fourth Way and Ouspensky's work and Gurdjieff's work, he is coming out and looking at food. That's interesting, isn't it? Casey's work, he's coming out and talking about food. And here we are looking at these headlines, oh, food shortages and GMO and, you know, all these types of things. There's a crucial piece here where they understood where that agricultural wave of scientific materialism ultimately was going to lead, which was a kind of slavery through food. And so the required independence and the things that would happen actually would be as a result of having a handle on this food aspect, but also food as a kind of spiritual tool and something that we would need to be aware of in relation to that. So what happens is Bennett, when he is, I'll sort of work my way into this backwards. When Bennett is doing Claymont and he is developing this independent mystery school that can survive, and basically he's looking to work with, as Gurdjieff had suggested, about 100 people in this regard. And those 100 people would be a representative of humanity. And it was those 100 people that would kind of start to shift. This is a very interesting thing when we get into these subjects, because very often people believe, well, you know, we have to change the entire society and all the rest. In fact, it is a small group that can change the entire piece. And I think that that's something worth keeping in mind as we go forward. This is Bennett there in 1970. There he is, 72 years old and really having accomplished a great deal. If we go back a little bit and look at Bennett's lifetime, it's quite remarkable because he had gone through a process of being, you know, in the Royal College and very well educated, sent overseas and all the rest of it. And he ends up spying on Gurdjieff. As a British spy, they're very curious about what Gurdjieff is up to and his trips through Constantinople in that period. And it's a hotbed of political intrigue and spy activity. And we're talking right around World War I. Now, what happens is Gurdjieff in this period is working with P.D. Ouspensky, and he is bringing forward this entirely unique system, which will eventually come over to the West, and things like the Enneagram and things like the stop exercise and consciousness exercises and things like that will show up as a very unusual mix of Eastern tradition with monastic tradition in terms of teaching, but freely available in the public suddenly. This is unusual in any case, because very often when you're looking at that, type of world. You're not seeing it. You definitely, you know, pass things in secret in monasteries and yogic, traditions. Those gurus would take on those students for years before they learned some of those deeper secrets. But here is Gurdjieff coming out and saying, you know what? This fourth way system can only be learned in the public. And this is something which you need to understand. And you really need to take a look at how you can only do the fourth way under public circumstances. You can't go away to a monastery and you can't go away, you know, to a mountaintop. And so you have to do it right in the center circumstances that you're in. You have to kind of keep your job and your home life and all the rest and just work it out through there. And the fourth way, the whole idea behind the name is that it's distinguished from the other three groups of enlightenment, where you attain a certain kind of spiritual evolution, and that's the way of the monk and the way of the fakir and the way of the yogi. And the monk is the priest lifetime, you know, that is adoring God and developing that deep emotional body. And the way of the fakir is, that's where, you know, in India, they lie down on a bed of nails. It's the real mind over matter, walking on coals path. But once you develop that, you're free to evolve in other ways because you've conquered the body. And then the yogic training is mind over matter. So it's, you know, you've sublimated that entire physical world to your higher consciousness. So those are the three. You know, there's a devotional path and there's the kind of mind over matter path. The fourth way is a system of developing all those same energies in everyday life. And so we run into this situation over and over again where Gurdjieff is explaining, well, you know, this is what's necessary. And he's talking all about man as machine and how we need to understand the machine. So when we think about Gurdjieff's work, we have to come in on it from that sense, which is he's saying, look, you've got a entire process here of industrialization, and we're surrounded by machines, and man himself is mechanical. So we need to wake up so that we're not mechanical and subject to mechanical influences. Then we can run any machine, and it's not going to make us more automated. When you're looking at that in 1920 or something along that line, it doesn't seem quite right, does it? Because, you know, you're looking at a period of time where you say, well, you know, it's not that automated. You know, they're starting, there's serious industrialization, there's railroads and automobiles, and it's getting there, and it is quite a departure. But the way that he's talking about it, again, reflects more into the 21st century, and you're going to find that exactly with the Steiner work as well. So I think that this is a key point for us to keep in mind as we move forward. So Gurdjieff, as he's doing these interactions, he is working with a prince in Turkey, and Bennett in that loop is ordered by the British Army to go spy on Gurdjieff, which is why he gets to know all about him. And during this period, he also discovers the work of Rudolf Steiner. And he is perched right between the Steiner work and the Gurdjieff work as to which way he's going to go. And that's an interesting thing when we get to Bennett's later life as the kind of hub of the whole situation, trying to draw all these different traditions in, like Subud and the Gurdjieff work and the Eastern yogi kind of tradition all into the work that he's doing. We can see early on that he's given a lot of very interesting options. He works with Uspensky, he works with Gurdjieff, and he's about to work with Steiner. So I think that Bennett, it becomes a very important person as a foundational figure for the kind of work that we're talking about in relation to this. But it's Gurdjieff's work that he's interested in. This is what we're talking about. And when we look at Gurdjieff, we really have to say that this is somebody who's coming out of a mystery school. In this case, the Sarmoon Brotherhood. And the mystery school is part of the Western mystery school tradition. So it's not part of the Eastern tradition, although it has those influences. It's definitely got that Western push, just like Rosicrucian aspects in the Steiner work. Whereas Theosophy really does shoot to the Eastern side. Gurdjieff's really part of that Western tradition, and it's the hidden tradition that's been kept underground and split up many, many years. So one of the things that we can look at when we get to Gurdjieff is who were his teachers? Well, that network is so underground and so hidden that even when he describes it, it's very hard for us to get a handle on what he's talking about, because, you know, there's no threads in public for where is it? How do you find it? You know, and this was the great quest that he was on. And so his book that he wrote after being really teaching for so many years, he didn't come out with a book and then start to teach the book. He did the teachings for decades. And then he came out with one book, which was Meetings with Remarkable Men, which was all about how he got led to the Saarmund Brotherhood. But it's an unusual story for the 20th century because, you know, Saarmund comes out of this deep tradition. It's an ancient tradition. It goes back to the Essenes and the Pythagoras school, things of these nature. So we're talking about very fine, deeply kept wisdom. And one of the major quotes from the Gurdjieff work is all about there's two things that exist in relation to the public. One of them is what to do and how to do it. And the what to do in spiritual traditions, you know, turn the other cheek and things of this nature. And then the how to do it always remains hidden. And it's those techniques and those understandings that get persecuted when they are publicized. And so this just creates a moving tradition. That is, it's not something you can always do and say, hey, there's that organization. It's there in public. It's a big foundation. I'm going to go there and work with a mystery school tomorrow. They can't do that. So they remain underground. But what gets to happen is through figures like Gurdjieff, through figures like Steiner, we start to get something different going. And that is the public mystery school, which has links back to the source mystery school. So it's the esoteric group entering the exoteric circle of influences in order to influence it and move that culture in a different direction. And in the case, I would say, of Gurdjieff, there's an immediacy to it. World War I is on the horizon. In Steiner's work, World War I is on the horizon. And they will go through these various wars, World War I and World War II, and you can see how that work pertains from how they put it out originally, and then the wars hit, and you're like, oh, now we understand where they were directing people to be self-sufficient, to not get locked into the brainwashing, to not identify and all the rest. And that's where the work becomes so exciting for this period, if we can find the links directly to what we're seeing here. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. We're going deep tonight on the mystery schools and the message that's vouchsafed for us here in the 21st century through their work, and how active that work is now, and how we can get to see that just by observing it. We're not going to be taking questions tonight because we're going to come back with the X series on the 29th with Miss Olivia. But at the end of the show, I'll definitely be looking at who's out there, and I'll try to grab some comments and questions from you. And I want to remind you, of course, to go to darkjournalist.com and sign up for our newsletter. That keeps everyone in touch as far as we go on this program. And we know with the intense censorship, that's really the best way for us to be. And that's right at darkjournalist.com. We've got a great ideas room tonight. And what I'm going to try to do in this report, we got maybe about an hour left, is to tie in these aspects of a little explored piece of J.G. Bennett and how it gives us that thread directly from 1875 all the way to 2022, and how that mystery school preparation is going to lead us into deeper territory. Of course, Uspensky, who I referenced there. Now, this is interesting. Uspensky wrote Tertium Morganum, which is a real breakthrough book, really celebrates theosophy. It quotes Madame Blavatsky. It's such a deep, esoteric book dealing with our place in the universe, physics, and all these different things. And he did that all before he met Gurdjieff. So he was already very well established. And by the time he met Gurdjieff, when he meets him, he said, well, you know, if you knew everything, if you understood everything that's in your own book, I should bow down to you as a master. But you don't understand either what you read or what you write. And that really was one of those intellectual shocks where Uspensky realized, oh, I'm observing it all with my head, and this guy's telling me it goes into different places, and there are emotional centers and things to consider. There's a whole different way of knowledge and understanding. So this becomes, I think, very important. in our understanding when we're looking at the Gurdjieff work. So Uspensky is absolutely crucial, and his foundational work, Tertium Organum and New Model of the Universe, fundamental if you want to really understand that mystery knowledge. As I've mentioned before, Uspensky is one of the few authors ever recommended in the Edgar Cayce readings as well, and the book was Tertium Organum. The other thing is that on a few different occasions, Uspensky will come up in those readings, and in one of them, Cayce's actually channeling him while he's alive. So Uspensky is projecting his consciousness into Cayce. Uspensky's in Russia or London or somewhere, and they didn't know each other at all, but Cayce's giving a reading, and suddenly Uspensky starts speaking through him. On another occasion, during a Cayce reading, and I think it's important to crisscross these mystery traditions. In this case, the Cayce work with Uspensky and Steiner. But one of the things that happens there is that when he's talking about him and they're asking him about Tertium Organum, Cayce starts to review his Akashic record and his life record. And he says, you know, this is interesting because we find that Uspensky was the person who was in charge in the mount for the people of the Mahaba. And this was, as we go back, he entered the world in the seventh day, the seventh month, the seventh hour, the seventh minute, 777. And just this weird, off the charts, bizarre rant that Cayce gives at that point. Nobody knows what he's talking about. But obviously, it exposes the fact that Uspensky is a very deep character, and Cayce in his unconscious state is tapping into how important the past life of Uspensky was. Of course, Casey's own former life, revealed more towards the end of his own, was as the priest Rata, the Emilius priest, who came into Egypt and tried to help them construct the Hall of Records and the pyramids as a place of safety for the fleeing Atlanteans, and also to keep that knowledge so that humanity would rediscover it once they had rediscovered that mathematics that is embodied there and imbued inside the pyramid. These are very important pieces because we have to understand how those schools speak to us. So when we think about a place like Notre Dame or the Great Pyramid or the Sphinx, embedded in it geographically and geometrically are principles that are spiritual, mathematical, and it is in this language and in these different ways that we are understanding that message, not so much as just interpreting their actual physical language, which over the course of 10,000 years can change dramatically. But they were giving us this message. So when I think about people I've encountered or met in my lifetime, like John Anthony West is one of them, for example. Here was somebody who was absolutely sure from his visits to Egypt and his studies of the pyramid and his early work. I was reading Serpent in the Sky recently. And, you know, we lost his work. He died a couple of years ago, but it was his work, Robert Bevall and Graham Hancock. And I've had the privilege of meeting Graham Hancock and doing a show with him here in Cambridge, which is available on this channel, and interviewing him on several occasions. But what I find from their work is they've tuned into the fact that there's this very aware stream of knowledge and consciousness that's embodied in these monuments, in these megaliths, in these ancient cultures that is reaching out to us forward. So by the time we get to Gurdjieff and people like that, they're aware of those traditions because they've worked with the schools. They're tapping into it. You know, in Cayce's case, he's going there in a special subconscious way in his mind and tapping into the Hall of Records and tapping into that piece. And it's those groups, again, of the kind of Rosicrucian Western ilk that's the stream that these groups are tapping into, as we find out through the work of Rudolf Steiner. Okay, so let's think about how this gets around to us. What I want to do is look at Bennett for a moment again, because Bennett, I find a very crucial figure in the middle of all this. A couple of quick things about him. I've noted earlier that he had spied on Gurdjieff, And that's how he got to know his teaching, by spying on him and being like, wow, this guy's incredible. I have to like follow his teachings. But he will, when he meets Gurdjieff and goes to France, and Gurdjieff opens his Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man, and Bennett goes to join it, but then he also realizes that he has so many things going on. He's younger, and he's just being given these different positions. And, you know, he's an oil scientist, and there are these different things that are calling to him. So he doesn't wind up doing it. What's more practical for him is to work with Ouspensky. The problem is those guys have split off from each other, and neither of their students can mention the other's teacher. That's how heavy that split is. And of course, Ouspensky is the greatest pupil of Gurdjieff. There's no question about it. And he brought forward his work in Search of the Miraculous. But nonetheless, right around 1924, they have such a split that Ouspensky basically says, I separated Gurdjieff, the man, from the ideas he brought forward. And Gurdjieff had this impact on people often. There's an irreverent style. There's a shocking style. You know, and sometimes it's just too much and it seems exaggerated. You know, at one point, there was a woman who'd heard these terrible rumors about Gurdjieff, and she went to Ouspensky, and she said, you know, could I ever work with this guy, or is he dangerous? And Ouspensky said, no, of course you can work with him. But there's no way that I can work with you if you work with him. It's just, you know, a fundamental separation of ideas. And the thing is, he said, I've realized that when Gurdjieff talked about the wheel of ideas and the different individualities that people develop, that in that wheel of ideas and wheel of identities, that Gurdjieff has come down to one very good identity and one very bad identity. And most of us apparently go around in that wheel of eyes, and we, you know, shift into a different eye every day. And so as a result, we don't remember ourselves. That's the kind of fundamental Gurdjieff teaching. And there's a way of self-remembering. Well, when we get to Ouspensky, he's realizing when he looks at Gurdjieff, oh, he's done a remarkable job. The only problem is he's down to one really good eye and one really bad one. But he must have thought that the good one had the upper hand ultimately, or he wouldn't have kept on with his teachings. But there's a definite split there, and it's well as illustrated in the book In Search of the Miraculous, which I highly recommend as a kind of fundamental, foundational text on the mystery schools. And there's a scene there where Gurdjieff has at one point promised Ouspensky that if he went along a certain way, he would see the miraculous from doing this work. And the original title of that book, by the way, is Fragments of an Unknown Teaching, which I think is very, very fascinating. In Search of the Miraculous was the name of a series of lectures that Ouspensky gave, and the publisher slapped that on there. But the actual name of the book is Fragments of an Unknown Teaching. That's crucial, because it is fragments, and where did this teaching come from? It's very hidden, this tradition of the Saarmung Brotherhood that's revealed in the Gurdjieff work and the Enneagram and all that. So where'd that come from? So, you know, we get hints that it's part of this deeper layer of the Western tradition, but it's so well hidden that there's not really a good precedent for it. You know, maybe some of the things that we hear about Francis Bacon and some of those traditions that are holding over from those older schools, but it's very unusual. I mean, even in these realms where you think of theosophy and all these things, it's very, very different. Because it discourages you from using your imagination because of the exaggerated tone of the imagination around theosophy. So I think that just gives us this foundation. So Bennett, having come through Ouspensky's work, having come through Gurdjieff's work, having worked on his own, having gone off and worked with Subud, which was the energy transfer, like healing, like an early Reiki version, but incredibly extreme. People would have incredibly enlightening experiences, or some of them would go crazy using this Ladi Han Subud experience from Pak Suba. So Bennett really had gone through these different teachers and had come out at the end of his life saying, we need to really make this school, not that it survives forever, but like many of these mystery schools, it needs to survive now to create a precedent. So he created Clément. Now, when he set up Clément, he wrote an interesting little treatise that will give us a real idea of what we can take from it for the 21st century and how it relates directly to some of the things that we're seeing now, including that overemphasis on centralized control and that overemphasis on artificial food and things of this nature, and how crucial this is going to be for us to get our act together. So, and this is J.G. Bennett now, Call for a New Society. This is just before his death, and he has set up a group in West Virginia using, again, these Gurdjieff exercises, and he's really just, he's going for it. He's like, you know what, I'm going to create a fourth way school directly as Gurdjieff kind of envisioned, and we're going to go for it. So that's what he does. He has earlier attempts with this, including Sherborne and Coombe Springs, which are earlier archetypes of this. They're not quite ready. And I think by the time they get to Clermont, it's really something special. And unfortunately, you know, he passes away shortly after he founds it. But Bennett, Call for a New Society. Let's see how this kind of resonates with the period we're in. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. We're going deep here on the Mystery School message. We're going to go for about another 45 minutes. And this is more about the Mystery School prophecies and how it relates directly to the period that we're in through the figure of John Godolphin Bennett, who was the student of both Gurdjieff and Ouspensky. All right. And some of you Bennett followers I've met and spoken to, it's remarkable. It's great, the kind of impact. Whenever I've spoken to those people who work directly with him, the impact that he had on them, you can still feel that essence when they're talking about it. And it is remarkable. And I did study with a couple of different Bennett groups over time, and Gurdjieff groups and Ouspensky groups, in my impression, it's been a long time, but and I was really young, but my impression was that, you know, the people who are drawn into that work generally are looking for something remarkable, and they would get together in small groups to study the ideas, and that study level can actually breed some very excellent results, I would say. So sometimes people will write to me and be like, what, you know, kind of worldwide mystery school should I join? Or someone else wrote to me and said, you know, I think I'm in this mystery school right now, you know. And but the thing is that that's not the way it works. The mystery schools are very unique. And the things that you're talking about are study groups, because it's very hard to find the actual mystery schools. And then beneath them are lesser schools, arcane schools, and then public study groups and private study groups. So it's, you know, I mean, the ring of influence, I would say, in general, is public or private study groups. That's what we tend to run into in the run of everyday life. It's very rare to run across a mystery school. So if somebody is coming out of a mystery school, you know, or saying or thinking that they're in a mystery school, I would submit that you're probably in a private study school or in a school of study or a group study, which is great because it's developing an influence, a magnetic influence. But mystery schools, like if you were in a mystery school, you'd know it. Your entire being is transformed just by being in the presence of that environment. But certainly the public mystery schools, like the Gurdjieff teaching and the Steiner piece, the overhang is there. The influence is there. If you've ever gone to the Casey Foundation, you know, I don't expect the Casey kind of psychic power is there at the ARE, but I see the influence, you know. It's almost like going to the presidential library in a sense. So that's how I would think about it. They're public versions of these schools, but the actual schools are very deep, very secret tradition and sacred tradition. So it's not the kind of thing that you run across. And I think that part of the Gurdjieff work, the idea was, hey, you're going to run across it in everyday life. The fourth way is you're out there in the public. It's not hidden. Okay, J.G. Bennett, Call for a New Society. Progress and self-perfecting is not automatic. It requires use of the right methods and the determination to persevere against all discouragement. Very few people can achieve it alone, and for this reason, schools of wisdom have existed from time immemorial to provide instruction and to create environments in which all can contribute to the common aim. Now, schools of wisdom is another name for mystery schools. It's the same exact thing. Although such schools have always been present, they are little in evidence except in times of crisis and change. This is crucial. We're in that crucial change crisis period, and therefore the mystery schools may again make themselves public for a while. Crisis and change, when they extend their activities to enable more people to prepare themselves for the task ahead. We are now in such a period, 1974, okay? And more people are looking for methods and guidance to help them with their own problems. They wish to be of service, but can see only too plainly that things have gone wrong for lack of know-how. How many times have we seen that in a group? And are afraid of doing harm where they mean to do good. Sensible people are acutely aware that something has gone wrong with humanity. Many of us are. Our present society, based on great institutions that control economic resources and political power, tend to strengthen the materialistic and egoic sides of human nature. We need a new kind of society in which concern for needs of others and of nature as a whole will predominate over self-interest and fear. One obvious need for such a society, as we continue on here, is to change our eating habits so that the whole world can be kept from starvation. We need to be more self-sufficient and less dependent upon vast inhuman organizations. All agree that the world is facing a food crisis, though few admit its true gravity. The artificial stimulation of agriculture by mechanization and synthetic fertilizers is impoverishing the soil. This is exactly the issue that we're facing. There is a developed and undeveloped countries alike in a flight from the land that cannot be reversed unless life on the land is made exciting and rewarding as it was in ancient times. Now here he is endeavoring to say, look, food is fundamental. And having that self-sufficiency is crucial, because if you have these corporations and these political structures controlling the food supply, they can increase it or decrease it to whoever they want to. And if you're a dissident, you know, shut off your digital wallet, you can't eat anymore. So this is where, you know, Catherine Austin Fitz is fond of that statement. And if they don't want you to eat pizza, then you're not going to eat pizza. This is exactly the echo that Bennett is getting at here. And remember, he studied society from all different angles. This wasn't somebody who was just, you know, sort of floating around trying to get into different New Age teachings. This is a guy who worked with some of the top teachers directly from the mystery schools, including Gurdjieff. But he's also somebody who worked in political circles. He worked with oil geology. He worked in top corporations and in the military. So this is somebody who understands all those different facets quite well. And he's putting this together and giving us this message of, like, fundamentally, when it boils down to is food becomes a crucial aspect. Let's go deeper. It is typical of great institutions to ignore the human factor. Unfortunately, even in small societies, concern for the general welfare is paid lip service rather than readiness to make the sacrifices that are needed. Unfortunately, concern for others can be translated into effective action only by those people who are working for their own self-perfecting. Only people who sincerely wish to give rather than take, to overcome their own weaknesses rather than exploit the weaknesses of others, can create a society that will survive in the hard times ahead. The hard times themselves are a necessary factor in self-perfecting. There's one reason why schools of wisdom, mystery schools, can become active when mankind is approaching a time of crisis. The task ahead is now very clear. We must demonstrate that communities engaged in food production can provide a really good way of life. This calls for a new kind of society. We believe it can be created from small beginnings. The term fourth way school was used by Gurdjieff to distinguish the type of society we're creating at Claymont. A school of the fourth way exists solely to carry out an allotted task and to train people for this purpose. The task of Claymont is to demonstrate that a predominantly food-producing society can enjoy fully satisfying conditions of life on all planes, physical, intellectual, and spiritual. So this is interesting. And the echo that I've found when I was trying to find this thread through these different mystery schools relating to the future into the 21st century, in Steiner's work and Bennett's and Gurdjieff's work, there's a stealth factor there, and it is food. Over and over again, they're emphasizing it. And when we see this incredible emphasis around synthetic food and food shortages and created shortages and the abuse of agriculture through companies like Monsanto and the flight from the land, we'll look at the Dutch farmers piece. This whole interaction of the mystery school warnings about how crucial food was going to be as a foundation of society, and especially a society that was seeking to remain independent from the thing, then we start to see that what's been vouchsafed back there in those texts of the mystery school and these teachers is a fundamental understanding that food is somehow a crucial piece to this. And, there's a lot of people in the audience who are great gardeners and know a great deal about raising food and all the rest of it. I don't know anything about that. What I do know is that there's a fundamental understanding that control rests in certain types of powers and the ability to control things. And one of those control things that have been exercised over time has been energy. And oil certainly is a major part of that. If you went into any major political scandal, from the Kennedy assassination to 9/11, oil, there's a core of oil and a core of drugs related to all these different deep events. So when we study and when we look at these groups trying to create, and not the mystery groups, but the political groups that are sowing chaos in the world, what they're trying to do is create a kind of currency using food. And so therefore, they feel if they control seeds, and we know Bill Gates has all those incredible, buying up all those seed depositories and buying up land in America and all the rest. We know that this is leaning directly into this. And so what we need to do is take a look at how does food play into this mystery message that the schools have left behind for us? And what is the prediction that they have for us? And we're getting some of that in the work of J.G. Bennett, as we've just discussed there. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist Show, going deep tonight on the mystery school prophecies through the figures of Edgar Cayce, J.G. Bennett, G.I. Gurdjieff, and others. We're not going to be taking questions tonight. We don't have the lovely Olivia, but I'll do. We're going to go back and forth in the ideas room at the end of the show. And we've got Groovy running the ideas room. I see Gigi Young out there. Fantastic. By the way, Gigi just debuted a fascinating episode last night. Again, dealing so much with this kind of space cult aspect, which is absolutely important for us to get our heads wrapped around. It's funny, many of the great researchers who are dealing with the deep state and set up a concept around it, like Mae Brussel, for example, understood fundamentally that the goal of the deep state is control on the ground through space. And this is something that was a great Nazi goal, which is why all the emphasis on the rockets and all the rest, the reign of terror from the air. And it's a quick way to develop that. But once we really got our handle going in terms of GPS, satellite positioning, and all the rest of it, then it's a total different ballgame. And in looking at and working on some of the very early people who were put on this task, of course, Thomas Townsend Brown was somebody who worked on these deep projects for the government. And he was emphasizing that whole electrogravitics in this aspect, and they were hiding the work that he was doing because it was getting very close. And it was right in the core of that X technology. when we look at Elon Musk and Starlink and all the rest of it, we can find some roots, direct roots now, very, very deep in the work of James Forrestal. This comes from January 15th, 1949. Of course, Forrestal was the defense secretary who got all that information relating to the UFO file and thought, well, this is something we should probably share with the public, don't you think? And he, for a few different reasons, was thrown out a window at Bethesda Naval Hospital by the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, one of the things that was revealed before his death, January 15th, 1949, this is the Western Daily Press Bristol Mirror, and it is a UK newspaper article. But think about Starlink as I read just a little bit of this. Defense plans reach new heights. Artificial moons, originally an idea of the British Interplanetary Society, formed the subject of a top-secret report from U.S. Secretary of Defense Mr. James Forrestal, some details of which leaked out yesterday. Latest schemes to be considered take the form of four satellites poised in space. Remember, this is 10 years before Sputnik and all the rest, and NASA doesn't exist. Latest schemes to be considered take the form of four satellites poised in space, one at about 400 miles above the Earth, another about 5,000 miles, and a third nearly 200,000 miles, and the fourth on the moon itself. They're already contemplating the moonshot in 49. Basis of the Forrestal report is more practical and lists satellites under the heading of guided missiles, atomic rockets might be launched from such platforms, and radar signals should not be stopped by cloud or fog. And the weaponization of space that is illuminating from these top secret reports. Starlink, although it's set up there to be this, it's a satellite program, with Musk touting it and all the rest. And I know that the Musk subject right now, when we're looking at him and the funny thing around Twitter and all the rest, it is, you know, it's definitely amusing, you know, that he went in there to buy it and then pulled the rug out from everybody, exposed the fact that over half of their users are bots. I mean, that is very amusing. But remember also that we had, you know, all of these conservatives fawning all over Musk. And then he comes out and says, oh, I've never voted Republican in my life. I mean, this guy is all over the place. And I'm telling you, that's not an individual when he goes and says things. Certainly, he's an individual person. But the things that come through him are decided via committee. But let's think about Starlink for a minute in relation to these moons. So they're saying, hey, artificial moons is a satellite. So this is 49. Now we go some 70 years later, and here's Musk doing pretty much the same thing, but they're contemplating it with a military purpose back here. And the idea is the cover for the Musk program with Starlink satellites is, hey, everybody's going to get internet. But what was the first thing he did once he got that whole ring of satellites up there? He offered it to Ukraine in case they shut off, their internet got shut off, involving the United States corporation in basically an act of war in the Russian-Ukraine war. So, you know, making these threads, tying these threads together from what is military use, what goes through the corporations now, why there's a 50-year shutoff of the moon program, you know, landing on the moon in 1972 and not going back. How do you not go back for five decades and then start talking about, hey, Artemis? I'm going to tell you an interesting thing. There's a company that got in touch with me directly and said, you know, hey, we heard you're interested in Artemis. Well, you know, we represent Artemis, and we want to give you this deep immersion experience of Artemis, you know, the NASA program, and we'll give you all this stuff about it. You can introduce it to your viewers and all the rest. These guys are hard at work converting people around this Artemis idea. And I'm all for space exploration and the idea of peaceful space research. But the idea of war in space is a complete abomination to everything about our space program and the way it was set up. As a matter of fact, President Kennedy made very, very clear during his UN addresses that space should never be used for war because, you know, you just lock humanity into endless war by arming space. So he was engaged in treaties with the Russians not to put weapons in space. And that's what they were doing. Nothing that they had up there was weaponized. And, you know, it could have defense purposes and we could watch each other and all the rest. But, you know, then you get into another period of time into the 80s with Reagan, and they're talking about putting space weapons up there as a defense against nuclear weapons down here and sharing the technology. But then they get together with the Russians and they're like, oh, basically, like, this is kind of a cover, because what we really want to know is this is to fight off these UFO threats. Because what they're doing at that time is they're feeding Reagan really hardcore data that could look like a UFO threat, no question about it. So this is the interesting thing about our understanding about space and why we're in this kind of quantum situation, looking back here at the mystery schools and this period of time when these things are happening. What they're doing is they're envisioning us throughout these different eras coming up, and they're trying to figure out, what kind of tools can we leave on the ground for these people to work with? And one of those threads, you know, certainly that deeper understanding about space, but the thing that I was finding over and over again was food. And so this kind of got me thinking about, what was it that they were trying to imply? And when we see the current headlines the way we do, there's one stretch of what they've left us, and we see all the headlines about famine and food shortages and all the rest. But what's the other one? The other one that we're seeing now through Congress people and Elizondo and Mellon and all these different people is the UFO threat, which is also something that's the thread in the mystery school. So it seems that the mystery school paradigm, the thing that they've left, the kind of message, is relating directly on one end to food, and something that we're supposed to do or recognize about food in space. So, you know, there's a theme in here. And I think, you know, that Noah's Ark piece that we did in the last X series episode starts to get into it. Everyone, you're talking very, very deep tonight on the subject of the mystery schools and the message that they've left behind. It's great to be here with you on this special report. I see a lot of familiar faces out there, and things have been just off the charts recently with all the wild things going on. The resignation of Boris Johnson, Mario Draghi, and the Sri Lankan leader. That is quite a switch up. I expect to see more. Too bad Zelensky wouldn't quit while he's had it. And so we're looking at a number of these real shakeups here that are going on very quietly in the background during the summer. And we just know that we're in this crucial period, and it's sort of like a lull before the next storm. We've had certainly major storms here over the past couple of years. But now in the summer, they're kind of moving into this setup. And I think it's very good for us to tap into that wisdom and the things that were preserved in these groups as they faced different earlier versions of wars. And I want to be clear that it's not that we need to go back in order to go forward. What it is really is that we need to adopt the things that were left behind for us and adopt them for the times that we're in. The principles work throughout history, but, you know, the methods change, of course. And the same types of things, though, the same types of understandings that helped groups like the Fourth Way and Gurdjieff and Uspensky get through World War One, or help Besant and Blavatsky, you know, sort of set up this whole track, can help us, I think, can give us kind of a fundamental foundation in what has become an insane drive to keep humanity off balance and vulnerable to some unimaginable experimentation. So I think that we're in a very interesting period of time. But I know with the incredible feedback in the ideas room that these types of conversations and the type of interaction that we get, the level that we can achieve, you know, not being too serious, not going off a cliff with it, but having that understanding that this is a crucial period of time and the pressures that are involved, that's going to give us all sort of the the leg up on dealing with all this. I want to remind you also to go to darkjournalist.com and sign up for that newsletter. That's a free newsletter. And it keeps us in touch with each other. It also is something that is going to let you know about the incredible interviews that we have coming up for you this summer, along with some remarkable X-Series episodes, documentaries, and events coming up through the summer and fall. And some of them are absolute mind blowers. So you stand up and be counted to make sure you're on that list already. Okay, let's see how much I can get into that's left. Here's the thing. The piece then, I think we covered what Bennett was saying in relation to this, but I wanted to include this little quote that John DeRopp, who was a later student of Bennett and Gurdjieff, some commentary that he made about Bennett. And then a few things I found out about a gardener who spent some time at Sherborne and the emphasis that they put on gardening. So this is DeRopp talking about Bennett. Quote, in 1947, he went to South Africa to seek a location for the Fourth Way community. Like many other followers of Gurdjieff, the experience of World War II had made him feel that Europe was finished and civilization faced collapse. The idea of building an ark to save what was important for the future was very strong in the post-war years. This idea of ark, again, coming up important, and I think we need to explore it more. Gurdjieff, in Beelzebub's tales, highlighted the frequency at which information and practices of real understanding were lost to future generations in some kind of breakdown due either to natural causes or some form of mental aberration possessing communities. Boy, does that sound familiar? How about the incredible trans push, right? And the transhumanism aspect. I mean, this is really right on. With this came the idea of consciously preparing for the future so that what was valuable for the meaning of human life would not be lost. Incidentally, this idea of preparing for the future fused with Bennett's vision of higher intelligence operating from the future and naturally led to his advocacy of learning how to communicate with higher intelligence and, in the big picture, his concept of the emergent synergic epoch. The latter was far more than a humanistic vision of cooperation between people. Bennett's extraordinary concept was of cooperation between different levels of being, which implied different types of individuality. This actually parallels current ideas about ecology in terms of cooperation with and not exploitation of other forms of life. But it went much further, starting from Gurdjieff's ideas of reciprocal maintenance involving all levels of existence. This is really important, I think, and it rounds out their thinking so that we don't just understand them as people who were utopian in nature. They wanted to actually do an experiment of working with people, of working with individuals who were interested in spiritual perfection and conscious evolution. And this is, I guess, the remarkable thing about that school and its experiment. Now, a lot of people might say, well, you know, Bennett's work, he did a school, but then the school went away and his work is left behind. And yeah, there are, you know, there are thin representations and groups left behind of him. Bennett is not somebody who wanted a big legacy of these organizations left behind. His understanding of the Fourth Way schools and the way that they operated in public, again, small public mystery schools that would plant seeds, come out and do things, and then withdraw. This is exactly what he's done. But these groups then are groups of preparation. So they're kind of like public mystery schools in miniature. So, you know, something like Theosophy maybe have worldwide members and growing, and Anthroposophy certainly. But in miniature, you'd have small groups of 100 or less working in these types of way, developing these things and developing a network of these islands. This is what they were saying. The other key concept there that I think is fascinating is Bennett is looking and saying there's a future intelligence communicating directly back. This is a much better form of time travel, in my opinion. It's a connection. It suggests a connection, just as they had a connection with us. So there's you know, Bennett writing in 1974, a call for a new society. And here we are in 2022 with that same rising to that same level of awareness. And the interaction is some 48 years apart, but there's some connection there into that fundamentally. Okay, a couple of quick pieces about land rising, which I believe is a piece of this and opens up the understanding. Again, land rising comes directly out of the Casey work, and it relates directly to Atlantis rising. Atlantis being the continent that occupied the Atlantic Ocean, and its most advanced vestiges left over in the Bahamas before it sank. That piece was called Poseidia. The other two islands after it had split off were called Arion and Og. And Og is the South American piece that create the Inca civilization. And Arion is the group that goes to the Pyrenees and is basically associated with the Basque culture. So this idea is kind of fundamental, and what it becomes so crucial when we look out and we see that they're talking about, oh, the climate change, and, you know, there's all these waters rising. There's all these different things that are happening. And what we're looking at is fundamentally, they never discuss the other aspect, which is land is rising as a result of this change. Now, very often in climate circles, they say, oh, you know, those bad people, what they did is they burned all these carbons into the atmosphere, and now they need to pay for it. So fundamentally, environmentally, I think we should have a much deeper conversation, especially when it comes to alternative research. It gets blown off a lot because it's such a manipulated subject matter. And they want to say, oh, there's a greenhouse effect and people are terrible and they have to pay us taxes and we need to control their lives. This is where all their program is coming from. However, for the ecological destruction that has taken place, who is really responsible? It would be the corporations who are sitting there with billions of dollars on their balance sheet who have profited the most and who didn't take into account when they were selling different products to people who were, after all, are just out there in a marketplace putting their money down, buying a product that they need to buy, whether it's an iPhone or something else. And, you know, the corporations themselves, if they profited the most and they destroyed the environment and they sold those products to us, then it becomes a process that they need to engage in to clean up the mess that they've made by profiting so much by using unsustainable practices. In fact, it has little to do with the public, except that the public should drive the process of that modernization. Instead, there's this top-down thing that, hey, we can claim more control because there are issues and problems with the environment as a result of this. The food piece is exactly like that. The things that we saw go on with the truckers, for example, and you know, so many of the strikes and using the emergency powers by Trudeau in a fascist sense, and really, you know, tying up all their money and all that, is a prelude to bringing on what? Automated transportation. It's obvious. And that's why they have Musk out there with Starlink, because how do you control all that stuff? You need Starlink up there to do it. So these pieces go together quite well when you look at it. So what does that mean, though? If they're controlling through, not through truck drivers, but through automated means, who gets food and who doesn't, then it becomes a very different kind of world in that sense. And so we can start to see the whole picture as we're looking at it. From the advance in technology and from the things that we're seeing on the surface, everything that has a scandal wrapped around it at this point is something that they want to replace, whether it's involves medicine, whether it involves politics, whether it involves how we get things. Remember all those shipping containers that were just hanging off the end of the coast and couldn't get into America to deliver those goods? These are engineered crises, but for what purpose? Again, we need to go deeper into the purpose, not jumping immediately to what we think might be behind it, but to give it a good, very deep look at where that's going. But certainly and fundamentally, when they allow inflation to go to 9.1%, as they have, that's the highest since 1981, when it was coming out of the Carter-fueled inflation, which was all about oil and the oil shortage that they had created, because they wanted to have higher prices and they intentionally left oil off the table so that it wasn't in circulation. It created gas shortages and the prices went up. That type of environment, when you go back there, you know, the interest rates were 21%, the inflation rate was 14%. That was the kind of edge of a cliff before the Reagan administration came in. That is the inflation that we're seeing mirrored now. There's no reason in the world 40 years later that we wouldn't have that problem under wraps. So this is a created environment, and they're even creating it at a risk to their own political peril, because as we've seen with groups like Stepford Biden and Trudeau, they already know that they don't have the leadership ability via their following. They don't have over a 50% governing majority. They're under 30%. So they don't have a governing majority. So the only way that you can govern is through emergency powers. A food shortage is an emergency. The COVID thing, they were able to pass it off as an emergency. The trucker thing, it's an emergency. Continuity of government. NORTHCOM takes over in the event of an emergency. The UFO threat. Oh, it's a global emergency. We need all this funding. Mike Gallagher, you know, and Marco Rubio and Senator Gillibrand tying it to the National Defense Authorization Act. The UFO thing fundamentally doesn't have anything to do with defense at all. It would be a scientific endeavor, if anything. And they've been hiding and sitting on that work for 75 years or more, as we said. So much of this and so many of the things that we're seeing are smoke and mirrors. To what end and to what purpose? So we're getting a hint in that leftover piece from the mystery traditions as to where these things are coming from. And so the era that we're in is really unraveling all this. So what I want to do is cite a couple of examples in the early 80s about land rising. And just so we understand, this is something that happens. And then I'll show you an even more modern version. By the way, there was a really a volcanic island that came directly out of the water just something like 3 months ago. All right, let's get into a couple of these. This is from Earth Changes Update, which is a book that the Casey Foundation puts out every once in a while. This one is actually from the 90s. But in the one of the 1152 series of the Casey readings, he says, in the next upcoming years, lands will appear in the Atlantic as well as in the Pacific. Now, part of what the global groups are doing and the World Economic Forum groups are doing is they're suppressing that part of the rising. And they're talking all about, oh, coastlines will be flooded, because they have a control piece where they want to come in and take control via climate change. But they don't want to tell us, the public, about lands rising, because they want those lands and they don't want them under the jurisdiction of the United States. They don't want them under these different jurisdictions. They want to grab those lands without any other piece. Now, we've seen individuals try to do this with the whole Atlantis rising thing. I talked about this with Ernest Hemingway's, citing Ernest Hemingway's brother who did this, and there have been other people. John Lennon did, I found out. And if you go deep into it, they buy different lands, lots in the Atlantic Ocean for land that's rising. And when that land rises, if it rises in international waters, it is a separate country. It's not subject to these different countries. That's a piece of what's important here, but there's also a very deep symbolic resonance to Atlantis rising. That's very ancient in the psyche of humanity. In this lengthy article by Richard Pothier, he's seeing rocks coming up again in the same regions of the Atlantic. This article goes on to state, new island excites scientists. This is now, remember, back from the 80s. Moffett Field, with a mighty heave and loud gasp, Mother Earth gave forth a new child on a cold November morning, 1963. An island suddenly sprang up in the Atlantic Ocean near Iceland. Propelled by mighty volcanic forces deep in the bowels of the earth, a rocky point jutted up through the frigid sea and grew until it spanned more than 2 miles. Icelanders called it Surtsey, for an ancient Norse god of fire. Two delighted scientists here who recently trampled over the rocky volcanic isle are calling it an exciting sample of Earth as it existed billions of years ago. And there's newspaper article after newspaper article. Two islands rising towards birth out of the Pacific. Washington scientists Saturday reported signs that two submerged mountains in the northeast Pacific are slowly rising and may eventually lift their summits above the water as new islands. In a Casey reading, he talks about, you know, what's going to happen there. They're saying, look out into the future. And he says, well, large landmass is going to rise off the East Coast. and that East Coast piece looks like it is the Florida East Coast. And then in one of these questions, he's asked, how soon will the changes in Earth's activity become apparent? And he says, when there's the first breaking up of some of those conditions in the South Sea, the South Pacific, and those as apparent in the sinking or rising of the almost opposite in the Mediterranean or the Etna area, we may know it has begun. This is very interesting because if you track the volcanic activity of Etna, you see it's been very active over the past couple of years. And the inundations, what kind of gives a hint for when land is going to rise. One of the inundations that he talked about involved California and Nevada. So this is, you know, one of these things that was projected out there that he was seeing very clearly at the time. I want to, just for the hell of it, I was reading through a couple of Casey's dreams. And some of these are so fascinating that I just, you know, they are dreams. They're dreams he had while he's giving a reading. And this is very interesting, in my opinion, that Casey had the ability to do this. Here he is. He's giving a reading in trance. And while he's giving a reading in trance, he's also having his own dream. but these dreams are very interesting when you go back and look at them. One of them is, as he reported it, this. It's pretty quick. I'd been born again in 2100 AD in Nebraska. The sea apparently covered all of the western part of the country. As the city where I lived was on a coast, Nebraska was on the coast. The family name was a strange one. And at an early age, as a child, I declared myself to be Edgar Casey, who had lived 200 years before. Scientists, men with long beards, little hair, and thick glasses, Google glasses, maybe, were called in to observe me. They had decided to visit the places where I said I'd been born, lived, and worked in Kentucky, Alabama, New York, Michigan, and Virginia. Taking me with them, the group of scientists visited these places in long cigar-shaped metal flying ships, which moved at high speed. Cigar shape. This is very interesting. Here he's giving this 1930s dream. It's way before any of these UFO reports have hit. And we know how many of those cigar-shaped UFO reports will come up in relation to the UFO wave. But keep that in mind. Here he is talking already about it. Taking me with them, the group of scientists visited these places in long cigar-shaped metal flying ships, which moved at high speed. Water-covered parts of Alabama, Norfolk, Virginia had become an immense seaport, and New York had been destroyed either by war or earthquake and was being rebuilt. Industries were scattered over the countryside. Most of the houses were made of glass. Many records of my work as Edgar Casey were discovered and collected. The group returned to Nebraska, taking the records with them. It's a pretty interesting dream for a lot of reasons, just considering the kind of psychic ability that he had. And also, later in that dream, he's walking around looking at this incredibly destroyed, blown out dystopian nightmare place, and he asked the construction worker, where am I? And the guy says, New York City. So something is there in his unconscious projecting forward and looking out. In June of 1938, Casey was giving the blueprint for social programs that would come up in the future, including the Great Society. Quote, a new order of conditions is to arise. There must be greater consideration of the individual so that each soul becomes his brother's keeper. Here's the really deep religious track that Casey was on, being a deep Christian, even though he was, you know, over and over again, when he was belonged to different churches, they'd throw him out once they found out he did psychic work. That was the end. Certain circumstances will come about in political, economic, and the whole human relationship in which a leveling will occur. a greater comprehension of the need for it. The time or period draws for such changes to come about. It behooves all who have an ideal, individuals, groups, societies, to practice the application of this ideal. Unless they are up and doing, there must come a new order for them in their own relationships and activities. This is interesting. I think what I hear there is if we don't create something of these kind of independent push, if individuals aren't up and doing, then they will be subject to this new order. And later we get the new world order directly. Then here's another thing that goes along with it. And nobody's ever been able to figure out this very strange prediction by Edgar Cayce. But here we go. When many of the islands of the sea and many of the lands have come under the subjugation of those who fear neither man nor the devil, who rather join themselves with that force by which they may proclaim might and power as right, as of a superman, who is to be an ideal for a generation to be established, then shall thy own land see the blood flow as in those periods when brother fought against brother in the Civil War. How fascinating and how odd. But this thing about a character or Superman is something that I tie directly in with Ahriman's incarnation and the idea that Steiner was giving us, that there's going to be an incarnation in this century of Ahriman physically, and possibly, and the way he talks about it, that preparation has already been made. But what he's talking about, and what's so very interesting there, is the idea, it seems like the incarnation of Ahriman is a incarnation of a cyborg. It's very technological piece that's added there. And it's the projection, I think, that these transhumanists are moving towards. Here is another piece on Land Rising from a Cayce researcher, Jess Stern, who was a journalist, New York Times journalist, who they were looking around at this publishing house and for someone to write the story of Cayce in the 1960s, 1968. And he wrote a best-selling book called The Sleeping Prophet on Edgar Cayce. But he was a little skeptical about writing the book at first, and he goes to the ARE, and he's reading through different Cayce readings. And one of the things that he finds that's very interesting is the different people who will bring forward this Cayce message to the broader public. And he's going through there looking at these different names that Cayce is giving in trance as a kind of stream of consciousness. And right in the middle of that stream of consciousness, his name pops up. Casey's giving the reading in 1942. Jess Stern is looking at it in 1968. He's like, what's this? What, Cayce predicted that I was going to do this? And then he does it. And it's a bestseller. So it's a really strange story. But anyway, just a little more around Land Rising. This is Stern. Reflecting the instability of the ocean bed in the area of the Azores, a British freighter reported sighting a steaming volcanic island just off the Azores before the turn of the century. But the island had disappeared before geologists could get back to it. On a smaller scale than Atlantis, land has dramatically vanished in various parts of the world. Just to give a little history, in 1883, the geologist noticed the island of Krakatoa near Sumatra blew up with the loss of thousands of lives. In 1916, Falkland Island east of Australia disappeared without a trace, reappeared in 1923, then disappeared in 1949. In August 1923, the Western Union Company, searching for a displaced cable, discovered that the Atlantic floor had risen 2 miles at one point since the last soundings 25 years before. 2 miles. So when we see some of these pieces that, you know, when we're speaking about Land Rising and all the rest of it, that should be something that is on the radar because there's so much history behind it. And geologically, there's so much history. And it's fundamental in all the mystery school teachings, but you never hear anything about Land Rising. So that's a big piece that we need to put on the agenda. I want to say that there's a flimsy, you know, there's a lot of weird things going on with Atlantis. One of the funniest that I saw is in Dazed. So when they were talking, they wanted to do an article on Atlantis. They didn't go to Gigi Young. They went to a couple of TikTok girls here. And it's, is Atlantis resurfacing inside the internet's latest spiritual reawakening? And they've got these TikTok girls who talk all about Atlantis. And, you know, they have all these remarks here in Days that are like, well, you know, it is kind of a white supremacist thing to think about that there were these really powerful white Atlanteans, you know, and it's not a very PC message. I thought that was really interesting. And just another quick piece, the legendary Yucatan Hall of Records found at Yaxchilan, Strange Labyrinths and Edgar Cayce. There is a lot of interesting research and articles going on in relation to Piedras Negras. And Piedras Negras, they're really one of those interesting spots that very well could be the Yucatan Hall of Records. What's going on and what's the game changer in all of the archaeology is the LIDAR technology. And this is something that the late Carmen Bolter, our dear friend, was trying to explain to me before her passing, that this technology was making so much of the earlier archaeology completely obsolete, because the type of X-ray that they could do with that radar on the ground, you could see everything. And she said, you know, they're going through and they're looking in Brazil and in the Amazon, and they're seeing complete, they have this whole outline for cities and things that they're going to have to figure out how to get at and all the rest. So they've gone into a game changer role in all this. That is the powers that be with Starlink and all the rest of it. They can look at the Earth just like, as we've talked about, the ruins in the hot zone that have been in the middle of this battle for so many years. A lot of it, a lot of that battle, you know, now they have much better tools to examine these things, and they can see those ruins. And so things like the Two-Eye Stone, things like the Atlantean temples, the Atlantean metropolis off the western tip of Cuba that Polina Zelitsky found, for example, we're in a different paradigm. And those people don't know how to explain it to the public. And they want to kind of keep the information for themselves also. They like to hide it from the public. But what they want to do is create a false narrative around Atlantis and a false narrative around the UFO file in order to keep that level of control. This is the nature of the warnings, I think, that we got from the mystery schools around these things, and the nature that of the problem that we need to figure out at the period that we're in here, using this foundation of the public mystery schools that came forward, and also compelling this era to kind of pick up the mantle around it, and for groups to find these answers on their own without relying on that central structure, whether it's a corporate or political structure. It's absolutely anathema to humanity and its progress. And, you know, so whether it's Atlantis rising or the UFO file and UFO file disclosure, that's not something that you want in the hands of these people. And by the way, they have their narratives cooked up. And just like the Mars narrative that they're cooking up about, you know, oh, early humanity is actually based on Mars, and like, you know, certain people on Earth are gods and all the rest of it. These are the types of things that they're trying to figure out. How can we slip this through? They should be subject to extreme scrutiny. When somebody stands up from the Department of Homeland Security and talks about punishing amateur interest groups for looking into UFOs, it should be under extreme scrutiny, and it should be talked about and loudly on independent sources of media. That's what it's all about, just like a political outrage. You know, when you get into these things and the changing of the narratives around them, the public at large is not well enough informed. And I've said this before about the media figures that get into it, like the Megyn Kellys or Tucker Carlson's and all the rest of it. You know, they talk to Lou Elizondo, CIA people and all that. So they don't know anything about the subject. They just are like, oh, hey, the public's interested in this, I'm going to jump on it. And that's not good enough. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. Whew, we've gone deep on this deep report here with you tonight. And it is outstanding to be here with everyone. I have a couple of things, and then we're going to wrap up tonight. And we'll do QA the next time that we're live. And we have some really sort of terrific interviews coming up for you for the rest of July. And the X series, of course, coming back July 29th with Miss Olivia as well. And we'll be taking your questions. We'll do a special Q&A for that one, because I know we've been missing that. Okay. I also want to remind you, go to the darkjournalist.com website, sign up for a free newsletter, make sure that you stand up and be counted, and give us that direct line of communication one to another. We've seen the incredible repression around these social media networks that just happens. And it, at this point, it may be so automated, it's not even an individual that's doing it. So we need to create as many channels of communication as possible. That newsletter is a good one. What I've found in general is it's an easier way of communicating. And even if you don't get notifications on something like YouTube, but to the question of, will we continue to use the social media networks? We'll use them and spread the word on the work that we're doing for just as long as we can. and hopefully that continues on and on, because I love the networks and I love working with the stuff. The only thing you can say about people who do that kind of censorship and repression is that they're afraid of something. And if they're that afraid, in the era of the open internet and all the rest of it, the thing that they must be building toward is redevelopment, you know, the new internet, and only the good people get to be on it. And so to create a kind of ideas ghetto, this is the nature of their thinking. And they tried it, you know, with the vaccine craze, they've tried it with other things. And so for me, it's the work. It's such an exposure of their own weakness, because they're saying, how can we keep these people from talking? Think about if you're afraid of people talking, that's fundamental. In America, it's ingrained. There's your First Amendment right to free speech. I mean, come on. So you're just not going to get around it. Every official from a judge up to the president in America swears an oath to that constitution, and you've got free speech in there. There's no way around it. You can't say, well, certain speech is protected, but other speech isn't. Oh, sorry. No, it's one, it's one big package. Okay. Couple of quick things. Actually, I'll end on the Steiner section. And we can never, we've done a lot with Steiner, but Rudolf Steiner and his work in spiritual science and anthroposophy as an Austrian mystic and just a real genius. He's so prolific that it's almost like looking at about five or six different people and what they did with their lives and his incredible, sort of prolific background of work is just there as a library of inspiration. And so we have all that, and then we have all the lectures that he had were originally meant to be just for his students. And that's where the work around Ahriman was really focused, although he's mentioned earlier. Steiner used the word for the Persian devil, Ahriman, A-H-R-I-M-A-N, to describe the force that was attacking humanity and was in particular going to create through technology one of the ultimate tests for the human spirit. Ahriman and the Ahrimanic powers is a very erudite secret to let out. And this is something that Steiner did that I think is unique. Certain things have come out of the Steiner work, like the clarification of the eighth sphere. These things that are occult secrets that were crucial for us to know, but also highly volatile and highly dangerous. The Ahrimanic sculpture, of course, that Steiner did unmistakably and sculpted, he was giving us all a hint there that this is what he felt we were up against. This is his own personal impression of it. He also said that when he was carving that the more he focused on Ahriman, the heavier he felt that he was. That he felt like he was going into concrete. And it's quite fascinating because, Steiner had done work on Goethe. He had done work around Nietzsche. He was a real intellectual giant, but he had such an appreciation for nature and poetry. So he's a real Renaissance man. And at a certain point, he has this great kind of spiritual awakening and meets a Rosicrucian master. And then his own spiritual Destiny is set out. And it's, he sets it out with Anthroposophy originally, and it's quite fascinating the history there as it works, because they give him, through what Blavatsky and Annie Besant set up, they give him that foundation to move forward. And they put him in charge of the German branch of Theosophy, where he's very, very successful, in fact. But he has that realization that Theosophy is hitting hard times, and that it's become kind of a playground for all sorts of different influences. And it has an incredible political impact as well. So, you know, Steiner is getting the impression that something else needs to happen. And what happens indeed is Steiner's own work moving forward, but directly off of his earlier past there with Besant. And Besant, of course, carrying the torch of Blavatsky's work there from Theosophy. So in Anthroposophy, I think what Steiner did was smart. He was saying, look, there's so many things in Theosophy to be appreciated, but they've been influenced, over-influenced by this Eastern track, and it's the Western initiators. This is the period where the Western initiators need to stand up and actually take on the burden of doing the work that the Eastern initiators have set up. And it's a very interesting kind of the strife or the battle of the mystery schools in the 19th century that then roll us into the early 20th century. But one of the key points that Steiner made is that he felt that the mystery schools publicly were failing with the advent of World War I. And he said, if Anthroposophy and spiritual science can't accomplish, you know, that spiritual mission, it'll roll out again in 100 years. And that was at the end of World War I. So 2020 was the next window of opportunity. And we're in that loop, that window now. And so much of Steiner's work is coming up for us. But one of the crucial pieces, I think, that Steiner wanted to get across had to do with the biodynamic farming and the self-sustaining aspects of it, but also the awareness of Ahriman. So we would understand what was coming through the technology, not to avoid it, not to, you know, become a Luddite and just forget about technology, but to consciously apprehend the technology as a spiritual, intellectual, emotional, physical being, and not cut off that crucial aspect. And this is so much of the Ahrimanic, just as a small setup, the Ahrimanic powers are scientific materialists, and everything on the spiritual side needs to be cut off in order for them to achieve the kind of godhood on earth that they want to. Because as long as we have that spiritual connection, we are not in their control. This is how Steiner sees it. And he sees them very involved with our evolution from the earliest days. A couple of quick important pieces I'm going to try to squeeze in here from Steiner's work. And this one on Lucifer and Ahriman. Through this very growth of inventiveness, this is Steiner now, through this very growth of inventiveness in physical life, which cannot be averted in any way or by any means, the bodily existence of a human individuality in whom Ahriman can incarnate will become possible and inevitable. Possible and inevitable. This is interesting, too, the way he describes it. It doesn't sound normal. Did you notice that? It says, bodily existence of a human individuality. So this, again, the cyborg piece with Ahriman starts to make more sense than just, you know, him incarnating the way everyone else does. From the spiritual world, this Ahrimanic power is preparing for incarnation on the earth, endeavoring in every conceivable way to make such preparations that the incarnation of Ahriman in human form may be able to mislead and corrupt humankind on earth to the uttermost. That's pretty powerful. A task of humankind during the next phase of civilization will be to live towards the incarnation of Ahriman with such alert consciousness that this incarnation can actually serve to promote a higher spiritual development, inasmuch as though Ahriman himself, through Ahriman himself, humanity will become aware of what can, or shall we say, cannot be achieved by physical life alone. But people must go forward with full consciousness toward this incarnation of Ahriman and become more and more alert in every domain in order to recognize with greater and greater clarity those trends in life which are leading towards this Ahrimanic incarnation. The trend is absolutely, you know, ground zero for what he's talking about there. And it goes much deeper, of course, all of Steiner's great truths in Cosmic Memory and Lucifer and Ahriman and Theosophy. Those books are, again, just fundamental concepts. But the Ahrimanic work in particular, many of those lectures weren't even going to be let out, but the devastation of World War I, which we can't, it's hard for us to imagine, it's buried back there in so many generations that it's very hard for us even to imagine knowing someone from that period. But, you know, we go back and we look at this period and the devastation. This is the first time they used planes to drop bombs. It's the first time they had tanks. So we're looking at incredible devastation, Germany, Russia, UK, US, everybody's involved in this mess. And they'll come back for a rematch 20 years later. But what's fascinating, and of course they're risking World War III over in Ukraine with Russia now, and the United States has never been directly engaged in war with Russia since we've become a nuclear power. So, you know, the Cold War is a totally different matter. That's the whole point. So this is one of the stupidest foreign policy moves ever on our part, creating that situation and then the way we've reacted to it. And it's a disaster. And we should not keep dumping billions of dollars in, over there while yelling about a food shortage and cranking up everyone's inflation to 9%, actually 14%. So the Biden, you know, disaster thing that came out of that disaster election, you know, that whole piece just needs to, all of those leaders need to be removed outright. But I think what Steiner's getting at here and trying to give us a picture of is that the technology is descending upon us, the wave of the technology descending upon us. Now, part of that, I believe, is the X technology and what resides in the UFO file. That's also a piece of this. And getting that type of advantage, you know, I've had this conversation many times with people who, let's say, they don't quite grasp the extremes of the situation. And one of the things they'll say is, well, there's always been evil people, you know, like there were evil people in Rome. We had evil leaders then, but we got through it. It's true. Problem is, and what I think we need that extra tool intellectually is that to understand just how bad it is if a Hitler or a Stalin had the technology that we had now, or you know, a Caligula, because the technology is so penetrates down so much and surveils so much down to the DNA level that we're talking about something very different than we have ever looked at in history. So it is different. It is unique. And so the whole idea of World War III is even different and unique from the way they talked about it during the Cold War. This is a level of control of humanity and, you know, that whole global concentration camp idea that humanity needs to kind of snap out of that and, you know, start thinking of it in a totally different fashion in order to get ahead of it, or else it'll just become enslaved to that machine. There's no question about it. And I think this is something by using all the machine lingo that Gurdjieff work and Steiner's work, when they talk about mechanization for people, this is what I think they're getting at. They're giving us that foundation. And, you know, Casey is talking about it. He's saying humanity facing itself. And he's also talking about us facing a period in Atlantis where we went through the same thing. Because Casey's story, just like Steiner's story or Gurdjieff's story, is that Atlantis was a very high technological advanced civilization that went down. So we had all these things before. So this idea that, you know, they went from cavemen to us just ain't so. That's also a lot to take in. That's a real human origin story that the schools are trying to give us. So we're on a very different level there with that. everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show, deep on the mystery schools tonight. A couple of quick things and then we're out. But it's been great to be here with you. And I do think that we're in a crucial period and have those tools and should be aware of those tools that have been left behind by these mystery schools with keys to be unlocked from very deep places that they've left behind and the deep knowledge that's been vouchsafed for us here. I'll remind you one last time before I go to go ahead and sign up for the Dark Journalist newsletter at darkjournalist.com. Make sure that you're on board there with the exciting things that we have coming up for you this summer. And we'll be back, of course, on the 29th with a new X series episode. But between now and then, we're going to have some very fascinating interviews for you as well. Okay. Couple more things. Oh, just a couple of interesting anomalies. So we have a major solar eclipse going on in 2024 across America. This is one that was happening in 2017. And this is the Washington Post, but I just want to get you in mind of how these things work and who these people are. Psychic and the solar eclipse. Edgar Cayce's grave lies in the path of totality. August 20th, 2017. At 1:29 p.m. Central Time Monday, the shadow of the moon will slide over Riverside Cemetery in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, for 2 minutes and 40 seconds over the grave of the sleeping prophet in twilight. At rest there for seven decades, Edgar Cayce, the 20th century's most famous psychic who made predictions, medical diagnosis, and cosmological pronouncements while asleep for more than 50 years. What on earth is that doing in the Washington Post? What kind of messaging is going on there? It's very unusual, extremely unusual. And one of the interesting things, I found a very old advertisement for a Cayce. Cayce, when he wasn't doing his psychic work, was a photographer. And at times when his psychic work was making his life haywire, he would retreat from the psychic work and go back to being a photographer. That is one of the first ads that he had. And it said, "Have you seen our new light? It's worth your while. Come in and bring your friends." Edgar Cayce, photographer. He just took different pictures when he was asleep. I guess you could say his psychic eye was just a better camera, really. But he left an incredible legacy for us that we're still opening up to this day. I want to leave you with a quote, actually, from Annie Besant. And Besant's quote is quite fascinating because she's talking about what would be, and again, Besant was the head of the Theosophical Society who discovered Steiner, in fact, who was already pretty well established as an author, but he wasn't, as a spiritual teacher, he wasn't really so far ahead yet. So she's talking about the past in Atlantis, and then she goes on to talk about what we're facing in the future and how there's going to be a world teacher and a new spiritual order and things of this nature. But Besant, when talking about Atlantis, says, "Another great continent slowly rising." Again, it's fundamental. All of them talk about Atlantis rising. If you go into it deep enough, you're going to find it in Steiner's work. Of course, Cayce, very deep on that. But here's Besant. "And then another great continent slowly rising was prepared for the habitation of the next great race. And the fifth race, the Aryan, was taken away from Atlantis nearly 80,000 years before the Christian era. For in the lifetime of races, you must count by millennia, not by centuries. Gathered before one of the great catastrophes led out by their leader, the Manu." And she talks about Manu, the world teacher. Here's her description. I just think this is interesting coming from another mystery school voice. "He is the Manu, the man, the type of each race as it gradually is builded, the perfect man of every race who gradually develops in the race the qualities embodied in himself. And as the name man means the thinker, the reasoner, the intelligent one. So this is the name of the typical man, the Manu. Stands for the ruler, the lawgiver. and side by side with him, his brother, is the great work of evolution. That is the world teacher, called by that name in some of the ancient books of Earth, known as the one who embodies in himself the wisdom, which is the truth that feeds the human race. And these two, the ruler, Manu, and the world teacher, stand at the head of the two departments of which I have spoken, the types. And so she goes into how this relates to the various religions and all the rest. But here's a fundamental concept that's in theosophy that you don't see appearing very much in Steiner's work, which is this concept of the world teacher coming in and balancing out the situation. And through that world teacher, the great kind of spiritual renaissance. So theosophy, you know, they have it lined up. Hey, the world teacher is going to be there. The future's looking good. And Steiner, yes, humanity looks good. Oh, but wait, there's the war of all against all, and there's the battle against Ahriman. So, you know, we have a few problems there when we're looking at it, which is, yes, we're going to get through to this other thing, but there's a great battle ahead in this transhumanist Ahrimanic force versus humanity. And I think that, you know, as we go through these different X series episodes, looking at that battle from the different perspectives of the mystery schools, dealing with the Ahrimanic force, dealing with the Belial force and the Emilius chain of mystery schools that comes out of the Casey work, those things become crucial coming into this era, because so many of those challenges are coming in and coming into a very unconscious humanity. You know, humanity is starting to wake up from looking at all these different things. And, you know, they call it conspiratorial thinking and all these, you know, different types of phrases to get people to not look. But, and I don't think that looking at things and being aware of the level of trouble that the culture is in is conspiratorial by nature. And I don't think someone should be extreme or paranoid about everything, you know, at all. I think it's actually the most reasoned type of rational response to the absolute insanity coming from the leadership and those in the government and those in the corporations are really acting in such an insane fashion. And we get to watch it almost like bread and circuses on a every daily basis, whether it's Twitter or television or whatever it happens to be. So we're in a crucial period, that much is certain. And the type of work that we're doing with dark journalism and with the X series relies very deeply on understanding the threads and the foundation that those mystery schools through anthroposophy and through Casey's work have left for us, and how that relates to this period. And there have been schools that have come up after in public mystery schools, but I think fundamentally, as far as it goes, that really when you get to theosophy, anthroposophy, Gurdjieff work, and Casey's ARE, that's really the thread, because if you include Bennett and his work in that, and that is the thread I think that we're poised to pick up on here in the 21st century, and might be something that will be crucial and life-saving, certainly sanity-saving under the circumstances. So thank you very much. I'll do a couple of quick shout-outs for you here tonight, and so great to have everyone here with me, of course. I can't see. Mighty Raven, great to see you. Griffin Eagle, excellent. Melissa, Steve Basco, Groovy Bean. Groovy, you did a great job out there tonight. Thank you so much. Fantastic. Need to interview who? I missed that one. Oh, I think I know who you're talking about. Yeah, Johann Wolf. Great to see you. Daniel Cartwright. Make America Great Again. I like that. How is Joseph doing? He's doing great. Yeah, we just talked recently, and he's been busy, but we're going to have him back on the show actually very soon. And we have something very special planned for you guys. Some really interesting specials coming up this summer Gigi, of course, Joseph, just some really interesting stuff coming up and some other big surprises. Wow. Fantastic. Gil and Joy R. Thank you. Thank you so much. Really appreciate. And for all you who've done any kind of support of the show, like you've shown tonight through Super Chats, and to all our subscribers, thank you. You really are the ones who allow us to do this great work and go deep on a number of these subjects. And so I'm very grateful for all the support that you guys give. I know Kate's out there. It's great to see you. Melissa. Oh, let's see. Great show. Thank you. Guitar Malade. I think I read that right. That's great. Miss Hemptress. Thank you. Oh, we love you. There's Gil Joy. Gil and Joy R. Thank you. Great supporters of the show. Taj Jacobs. Thanks always. Thank you, sir. Oh, who else have we got here? Johan Wolf. Dark journalist, come down. DJ is the occult Brian Ferry. That's great. Oh, I could listen to some Brian Ferry right now. Outstanding, my God. Maybe I'll find that first Roxy Music. And there's some songs on there. I forget the names. I think one of them, 2HB. Unbelievable. Just incredible. Najat, keeping you busy. Absolutely. That's my job these days. Fantastic to see you, Najat. I know you're working hard. Thank you for your service to humanity and God. John Howard, thank you. Really appreciate that. And it's great to have everyone in the ideas room. I often mention that I get great inspiration from all the comments. I always read the chats inside and out, and the emails and everything that you guys send me, and some really compelling letters. I got a very nice letter from a supporter today, and just absolutely fascinating stories. So thank you so much. A couple more shout outs and then we're out of here for the night. What else you got? Scarlet Fire. What is that? White Horse, Fauci, Red Horse, Saki, Pale Horse, Biden, Black Horse, Harris. The four horse people of the Zodiac, of Revelation, rather. Deborah Blair. That's great. Is it a full moon? Wow. That I can see. I can feel it coming in the air at night, as Phil Collins would say. Who else we got there? Miss Hemptress. DJ, you're the modern day Steiner. Oh my God. With a dash of Brokaw. Brokaw, you know, Brokaw did some good reports when he was starting out. He showed a lot of promise. He was pretty great. You know, the Ted Koppel, he did the whole, I found a recording of him doing the whole Russian UFO thing. And it was all about the Russian sighting and that weird landing of a craft in a park. And that's a really old report, but he did it on Nightline. Just unbelievable. Let's see. Who else we got? Peter. Hey, DJ should do a live tour. Well, you know, you keep talking about it. Just keep talking about it, because that something like that may just be in the works, may just be happening. But that was a great idea, by the way. Fantastic. Koppel was class. I agree with you. Nightline was good stuff. Who else we got here? Dar Smith. Great to see you. Debbie McAdoo, Supermoon yesterday. Hey. That's really interesting. Yeah, I've still been working on that astrology show. That is, I've narrowed it down to some fascinating people. I got so interested in reading their reports. So that's going to be great. Brandy Renee, it's great to see you. Catherine Harris, what was that? Wait, someone said, can I get a shout out? Who is that? Snail Queef? Is that how you say that? You're a pioneer, DJ. You've created a new wave of infotainment. I like the pioneer. You know, it's always good to be called a pioneer and doing this stuff. And I try to be original, I'll tell you. I miss Johnny Carson. That's interesting. Find that clip of Johnny Carson interviewing Jim Garrison. It's hilarious. Let's see here. It's getting wild. You know, what's great is like as the night wears on, the comments get wilder and wilder. The Leo King. Yeah, well, he's really, really something. He's a character. I have to watch more of his stuff. Hey, you wonderful beatnik post historian scholar. Thanks always. If I had a cigarette, I'd be smoking it with a cigarette handle right now. Let's see. Key Grace, Esther Taylor. Fantastic crew out there tonight. Thank you so much. It's been great to be with you. Thank you, Groovy. You did a great job on the ideas room. And Gigi, my hat's off to you. And everyone should watch Gigi's from last night. Her incredible, really interesting video she put out. Just go to Gigi Young here on YouTube. And what do we got that? I saw a name there. It's one of the classic names. Catherine Harris. That's great. Debbie McAdoo. She says, we will come to Cambridge if you're buying. I don't know about that, but it'd be great to see you in Cambridge. Let's see. John Howard, Lancelot Coles. So many great people in here tonight. We'll see y'all next week. And we're going to have some exciting interviews coming up for you. And on July 29th, X Series 129. You don't want to miss it. This one's a classic. And we'll have Miss Olivia back from that. I know she's thinking of you guys tonight. And we'll see you all next week. And you know, it says end broadcast, but after all, we know it never really ends. And just remember, I guess the big scoop out of tonight, J.G. Bennett and some of the things that Bennett vouchsafed for us. It's going to flash his picture before I go, because you know me and pictures. Well, there's a picture of his dance group, the J.G. Bennett dancers. All right. Thank you, everyone. We'll see you all next week. Have a great weekend. Good night.